the first refugee ever elected to Congress.
The machinery of democracy should work for everyone, everywhere, not just in certain places and not just on a certain day.
Power sees nothing without a demand. It never has and it never will. We still have to be willing to show up every single day and demand our seat at the table.
So f***ing proud of you guys.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 247. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is Andrew Torres, belt and suspenders lawyer. How you doing?
Well, I'm doing a little bit better after that fantastic introduction, and I was already doing great, so I'm amazing. How are you, Thomas?
I'm doing well. I feel like our country is not as good right now, currently. This is one of those not great news shows, unfortunately. They happen a lot these days, probably too much these days, but that's okay. We gotta cover the ins and outs. We've got quick Andrew was right / wrong. I like those. Those are always fun. We could celebrate and then scold Andrew in the same segment. I always enjoy doing that. And then we're going to talk, unfortunately, about the trans ban that in the military that I guess is now going through. I don't know what's happening. And that's why we have Andrew Torres. I can't wait for Andrew to give us the breakdown, although I say that. And then I'm worried it's going to be really bad news. So maybe it's right now. It's the Schrodinger's transgender military ban. I don't know. Is it happening or not? But I guess we're gonna check the superposition of that, and Andrew's going to tell us. And then finally, we're going to talk a little bit more about the shutdown that is still going on. It's absolutely appalling that this is still happening, but it is. And we got some more questions about that. Some more points for Andrew to talk us through. And that's it. Any announcements? Anything from you, Andrew?
I just want to promote your appearance on episode 179 of God Awful Movies, doing the movie One More Round, which is typically, you know, the level of hilarity that Opening Arguments listeners have come to expect from one Thomas Smith. You are super funny in it, and if you like to hear clown horns without the clown horn, head on over. We'll link it in the show notes. Everyone should check that out. It's really, really funny.
Yeah, it was really fun, and I love doing that show. It's one of my favorites to do. So fun, but now to the not fun stuff. We'd better talk, get on with the rest of the show here.
Hey, this is a reminder that we are going to have our monthly Q&A this coming Tuesday, that is January the 29th at 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 Pacific. We will get announcements out of the YouTube channel, which you can find on YouTube, and we will post as soon as we go live on social media. Anybody can attend the Q&A. If you are a Patreon supporter, you can head on over to the thread that's up and post the questions that you want to see answered and upvote with the heart the ones that other people have posted that you'd like to see answered. This is a lot of fun. And to be honest, it's a lot of fun in the comment sections, you know, sort of among folks watching us live. We always have fun with it. So if you've never shown up to a Q&A, give it a shot. That is this Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, January the 29th, 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 Pacific. Anybody can watch, and patrons get to suggest the questions. It's a lot of fun. See you there.
I'm asking you if you know the difference between right and wrong.
Maybe. Maybe not. Maybe.
Okay, State of the Union. Now it sounds like, last I saw, it sounds like Nancy Pelosi is holding firm on the no State of the Union, right, until the shutdown's over. But what were you perhaps right and wrong about?
So a couple of things here, right? We got a message from Joe D, who tells us, you said that the first president to deliver the State of the Union to a joint session of Congress was Woodrow Wilson in 1913. This is mostly right. However, the first president to do so was actually George Washington, followed by John Adams. But that tradition did not last very long. Thomas Jefferson delivered the State of the Union as a written report. Giving a speech reminded him too much of a king addressing Parliament. That custom lasted until Wilson revived the speech format in 1913. So really good historical point there.
That's so funny because I had seen the same thing and I thought I agreed with you. I was like, oh, yeah, I just read that Jefferson hated it. And therefore, Wilson was the one who first did it. But I guess, you know, Jefferson wasn't the first president of the United States. So that would be the flaw in that logic for me anyway. So, yeah. All right. Minor point. But you know, good correction.
Yeah. And then I also predicted that although Nancy Pelosi had the power to deny Donald Trump access to the House of Representatives to a joint session of Congress to deliver the speech as Speaker of the House, that the president would find an alternative venue. And as of this morning, that looks wrong, too. It looks like the president is backing down and will not deliver the State of the Union during the shutdown and will deliver it once the shutdown has been concluded. That's a thing I am super happy to be wrong about, because I think I had sort of backtracked from week to week. So you really want to talk about superposition. The first time we talked about the shutdown, I predicted that the political circumstances would be likely to kind of bring Trump to the table. You were pretty skeptical about that. And then I declared you correct and me wrong the next week. Looked like things had sort of moved backwards. And I would say over the past couple of days that that things certainly seem to be moving in a direction where, you know, Trump is, you know, he over the weekend floated what was described as a compromise position. There's no need to kind of get into the merits of it. It was quickly rejected by Nancy Pelosi. And, you know, we continue to see Trump doing a thing that he has not done, as far as I can tell, throughout his presidency, right, which is back down on anything. And so I think those are good signs. I don't know what your take is on that.
Good sign. What are the good signs? Oh, you think it's coming to a close soon just because of
I think the fact that Trump has come forward with a compromise proposal and the fact that Trump is not going to attempt to deliver the State of the Union during the shutdown, I think those are good signs. And I think those augur in favor of us being able to end the shutdown on the near horizon. Maybe I'm feeling overly optimistic.
It's just like trying to predict. I don't know, like you got a mouse scurrying around a maze or something and you're like, I predict that it's going to get to this part of the maze. I think it's going to happen. It's like, there's no prediction to me. It could, you know, like it could just go, bloop, bloop, oh, it's there or not, you know, or it could just never find the other end of the maze.
I think that is the greatest description, and I'm gonna go with that one. Right, mouse in a maze. Who knows if it's gonna get to that?
Yeah, because the thing that Trump does all the time too is that, like, right when there's signs of something happening, he'll just either hear Ann Coulter said something bad about him or what, and then he just totally reverses. You know, it's. Yeah. I don't feel comfortable making any prediction at all other than the only thing I was saying is I'm deeply worried. And I think that worry has been valid that this shutdown, because this was back in week one or two of the shutdown. I'm deeply worried about how long this could go on because I know he doesn't care about humans. Like there's no cost to him of this. Like he thinks it's all fine. And maybe the only cost is maybe if someone tells him a poll is going against him, you know, like maybe we'll get lucky and he'll care about a poll or something. But other than that, just in terms of human being stuff, like we can't rely on that. So he's not going to behave like a predictable person in that respect, I don't think.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. We've also mentioned that, shutting down the government is a feature and not a bug to this administration in a bunch of ways. And, you know, we're going to answer some more questions on that in the C segment. But but there you go. State of the Union postponed, question mark. And that definitely caught me by surprise.
I thought there was a good. I agree. I thought there was a good chance he was going to do it in front of a bunch of Trump water bottles or something, you know.
I honestly thought, and 100% wrong on this, that he would just go to
the boardroom.
I thought
you were gonna say the Trump boardroom, like he'd be back from you know, the Apprentice. He just did it there.
who knows, right? And just pack it with his supporters, and the networks would cover that. Well, at least we don't have to deal with the potential implications of that. So
we'll see. And next week we could be doing a wrong and right on the same set of questions that have flip flopped the other way. We'll never know.
Yeah. Yes, we could. All right. Let's. I'm in no hurry to move on to the main segment, but I feel like we should.
Yeah, it's just what we have to do. What's going on with this transgender military ban? It sounds like a court, you know, allowed it to go through. All right. Tell us in what way our horrible president is being awful for no real reason.
Yeah. And I want to start with, I'm going to link in the show notes. I've already shared it out over Twitter and in the Opening Arguments Facebook community. There is a really, really good article that was an interview with a longtime friend of the show, Alice Ashton, for The Advocate, that breaks down the reality of what the trans ban means. I think this it's a horrifying read, but in my view, gives some not just a human face to the crisis, but describes, you know, I've already had one discussion, you know, with somebody who said, well, yeah, how this is just, I don't, we have so many bigger issues going on. There are 14,000 trans service members, approximately.
Wow.
That is, yeah, 1% of the trans population as a whole. Trans individuals are overrepresented in military service, and trans people already have unemployment at three times the national average for reasons that are probably pretty obvious, not the least of which is in most jurisdictions you can fire somebody for being trans just because they're trans. So that's terrible, and it's about to get worse. And if there were any other population group in this country where an executive order was about to increase their unemployment rate by 1 to 5%, that would be outrageous. And that's the reason that, you know, even if you don't care about this on a moral level, and you should, right? But if you're talking to Uncle Frank and he doesn't care about it on a moral level, this is not just, you know, five people. This is not a handful. This is a significant chunk of the military, and it is a significant percentage of the trans population. What happened? And I want to go through the history, because we were on a good pace up until the Supreme Court a couple of days ago issued a series of rulings, and essentially what the rulings do is they stay the enforcement of lower court judgments that issued preliminary injunctions blocking the trans ban from going into effect. So, in other words, I'm going to talk about, there is some administrative work to be done to implement this. But as of right now, there are no judicial orders that prevent this administration from changing the policy towards trans service members. We're going to talk about the last proposed change, but it's bad. I mean, the current the last proposal by then Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis essentially said that that the government can discharge and refuse to allow to enlist trans service members. I'm going to talk specifically about the particular language, but that's the effect. It is an outright ban with a few very small exceptions. Those exceptions currently apply to under 1,000 service members, right? So less than a couple percent of the potential number of service members to be affected. And there have not been any implementing regulations, but those regulations are being written as we record this and will be put into place soon. And it will go into effect. There is, as far as I can tell, nothing that can be done at this stage to stop that from happening. So, yeah, go ahead.
I don't know what to say. I'm speechless. It's
yeah.
I don't know what changed. I mean, so I guess, as you're saying, there was a preliminary injunction, but yeah. The Supreme Court. Okay. Well, I'm
so here's what happened. Right. And let me say at the outset, the way that this is written, it is being characterized as not a ban on trans service members for reasons that I will explain in a minute, but a ban on people with gender dysphoria. Now, as you're nodding along, this is a really, really difficult issue right now in the psychological literature and in the trans community. I am not remotely an expert on those issues, but my understanding is that you can be trans and not have gender dysphoria, right? And leaving aside all of the issues surrounding, the treatment of trans men and women, where there have been all sorts of gatekeeping issues and the like. I'm not qualified to address those issues, but essentially the way in which the ban is presently written, according to the Mattis statement, is designed to say, oh, we're not discriminating against trans people so long as you serve in, and I want to stress, these are Mattis's words. These are by far not my words because they don't make any clown horn sense. But as long as you serve in, quote, your biological gender, end quote, you can continue to serve. That, that is preposterous.
Yeah, it's like if we said to gay people, oh, as long as you pretend to be straight, then you can.
Yes, that is exactly
what we did, right. I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Accepting that, gender identity. I mean, I don't want to get into a robust defense of don't ask, don't tell. Although, again, I will point out that, in the mid 1990s, it was a progressive step from we will fire you for being in the military if we discover that you're secretly gay,
right, yeah,
to move to, hey, you can be secretly gay, just, don't ask, don't tell. And again, I realize I'm oversimplifying. This is not a don't ask, don't tell segment. I think there is a fair argument that, right, sexual behavior is something you can keep private. Gender identity is considerably more expansive than that. And I think that's a good argument. I also want to point out, right, dysphoria, right? Like etymologically, right? Dysphoria is the opposite of euphoria, right? It is that conditions are, intolerable. Lots of people not in the stage where, that would be described as dysphoria to nevertheless want to identify as trans, to nevertheless, have this be, something that affects their lives. So,
yeah, I don't know if now's a good time to ask the question, but I'm curious if it's framed that way, how are we evaluating who has, like, are trans people right now able to just say, like, just to keep their job up? Nope, no dysphoria here. How are they going to evaluate that somehow?
Yeah, I will get to that when we talk about the specific policy. Sure. here's what it reverses, right? Because what it reverses, and again, this is yet another example of where the existing policy was perfectly straightforward and had no administrative red tape, and our small government Republicans decided to make it unnecessarily complicated in service of evil. June of 2015, the Obama administration and then Secretary of Defense Ash Carter ordered a year-long study of the feasibility of trans men and women serving openly in the U.S. military. They brought in the RAND Corporation, right? The most prestigious think tank in the world, nonpartisan, certainly not a lefty outfit by any means, right? Not, you know, a social justice, right? It's the RAND Corporation, right? And they studied for a year the effects of trans service on readiness, deployability, and unit cohesion. At the end of that study, they issued a report that said, no, of course not. That it also covered medical costs, right? It sort of preempted all of the stupid arguments that Trump has made. And same thing, right? That, you're not talking about medical costs that exceed the typical medical costs that service members have, right? And, you know, to use an example from the from actually Mattis's research, right, the standards on admissibility into the service are different than the standards for retention, right? So in other words, you have high blood pressure when you join up as an 18-year-old. Those are grounds for not allowing you to join the Army. But if you join the Army when you're 18 and then you develop high blood pressure in your 30s, as lots of people do, you then get treatment for hypertension, right?
Right.
In the military, you get the and we could do a deep dive on you know, medical care in the military. Let's put that on the whiteboard. But in other words, that trans service members don't have appreciably higher medical costs than other service members, right? And so that was the result of the study. As soon as it came out, then June 30th, 2016, Secretary Carter issued what is called the Open Service Directive. I'm going to link that in the show notes, I guess, so we can look at it wistfully. And it says, effective immediately, no otherwise qualified service member may be involuntarily separated, discharged, or denied reenlistment or continuation of service solely on the basis of their gender identity.
Yeah, doy. Yeah, by the way, going back to Uncle Frank, that's, I mean, I hate having to do these weird arguments where you're like, find a way to argue with someone who doesn't care about people. That's a hard thing to do. But I think that's a pretty simple. And it's sort of putting it in the Republican frame a little bit, which is if they're fit to serve their country, they're fit to serve. Simple as that.
And the very next that's paragraph A. There are only three paragraphs to this, right? There are other sections that are implementing, but the directives are basically these three paragraphs. Paragraph B says exactly what you just said, right? Which is, transgender service members will be subject to the same standards as any other service member of the same gender. They may be separated, discharged, or denied reenlistment or continuation of service under existing processes and basis, but not solely due to their gender identity.
Sounds fair.
Or an expressed intent to transition genders. Yeah. So, and that answers the arguments about because there are arguments being raised by the other side, I believe disingenuously. I don't know if these are factually correct, but the arguments are that trans men and women have higher rates of suicidal ideation. They have other issues that may make them unfit for military service. Obviously, the first response is, right, the reason that they have higher rates of suicidal ideation is, if they do, would be how they're treated in society. That doesn't seem to be a great argument. But the point is that if somebody has suicidal ideation and is not fit for military service, they could be discharged. Yeah. You could refuse to allow them to enlist, even if that is as a result, you know, or correlated in some way to their being transgender, right? It is not a situation where this becomes an absolute defense, right? This is a situation where it cannot be used as the basis for discrimination. And then the C provision says that a service member whose ability to serve is adversely affected by a medical condition or medical treatment related to their gender identity should be treated for purposes of separation and retention in a manner consistent with a service member whose ability to serve is similarly affected for reasons unrelated to their gender identity or gender transition. Right? So, again, I think answer sort of the medical arguments. It is difficult for me to imagine that non-religious right, ideologically motivated presidents could possibly in any way disagree with this order.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine reasonable.
George H.W. Bush getting into office and going, well, you know, by God, we're going to get rid of that. But Donald Trump did. And so on June 30th of 2017, Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis announced that was when this policy was scheduled to take effect. Right. So again, you see the Obama administration's approach, which seems so quaint now, of we've got a problem. Okay, well, let's study it. Let's make sure that we're proceeding, you know, prudently. Okay, we're announcing a major new change in June of 2016. Let's give the military a year to implement these changes, right? Mm. Let's because we get it, right? And we want to balance out. We don't want charges that we're being reckless, and so it was going to take a year to open up.
As they say, Obama would have made a great president. I mean, I think he was a great president, but he was from another time. Like he was doing reasonable things that you used to do when everything was reasonable.
Hey, listeners, you know what's not smart? Job boards that send you candidates that aren't qualified for the role you posted. That is infuriating. That used to happen to me back when I was hiring people. It's a waste of time. You know what else is not smart? Picking a public fight with Nancy Pelosi. She'll she'll get you. But you know what is smart? Going to ZipRecruiter.com/OA to hire the right person. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates for you. Its powerful matching technology scans thousands of resumes to identify people with the right skills, education, and experience, and actively invites them to apply to your job so you get qualified candidates fast. That's why ZipRecruiter is rated number one by employers in the U.S. This rating comes from hiring sites on Trustpilot with over 1,000 reviews. And, you know, as I mentioned, I do have a little experience hiring people, and I cannot tell you how valuable it is to have the right candidates. It's frustrating when you get a pool of candidates, none of whom you're really in love with, but you really need the job done, so you hire somebody suboptimal, and then you're kind of, that's a whole other can of worms. You want the right candidates fast. And right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address. That's ZipRecruiter.com/OA. If you love this show, you can show your support and you can get a fantastic service by going to ZipRecruiter.com/OA. That's ZipRecruiter.com/OA. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Yeah. And so that was going to open enrollment, enlistment to trans service members. And Mattis said, I'm deferring that by 6 months. Right. New administration. We're looking at it. I'm deferring it by 6 months, but I'm not making any changes to the open service policy during those 6 months. But a month later, Donald Trump took to Twitter. And what Donald Trump said on Twitter was, quote, the United States will not accept or allow transgender individuals to serve in any capacity in the U.S. military, end of quote. And that then led to the immediate filing of lawsuits. And good on these heroes who filed the lawsuit and, who now, may be in a very difficult position. So there were four different sets of lawsuits filed, one here in Maryland, Stone versus Trump. I'm going to focus on that because there's a weird procedural thing. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit about that. But all of the lawsuits allege the same thing, right? Which was that rescinding the open service policy was, among other things, a violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Talk about that in a minute. After Trump's tweet, August 25th, 2017, the president issued a memorandum stating that, in his judgment, the Department of Defense had failed to identify a sufficient basis to conclude that the Open Service Directive would not hinder military effectiveness and lethality, disrupt unit cohesion, or tax military resources. I'm going to upload that memorandum as well. So this is an executive order. It's an executive memo, but has the same force of law as an executive memorandum, as a directive to the Department of Defense. And that explicitly rescinded the open service policy, the Carter open service policy. And then he directed the Department of Defense and the various branches of the military should return to the longstanding policy and practice on military service by transgender individuals that was in place prior to June 2016, i.e. a comprehensive ban and being able to discriminate against them. And it also banned the enlistment of trans individuals. Right. That is that word. I learned this while researching it, so I'm going to share this with our listeners, is called accession. Don't ask me why the military has a special word for enlistment when enlistment would work. But it was a ban on accession. And I was like, what on earth is accession? And that means joining the military. So so ban on retention, ban on accession, and a ban on sex reassignment surgery. And again, this is the language used in Trump's order. Right. Directing that the various secretaries of the armed forces, quote, shall halt all use of DOD or DHS resources to fund sex reassignment surgical procedures for military personnel, except to the extent necessary to protect the health of an individual who has already begun a course of treatment to reassign his or her sex, end of quote. And again, their language, not mine. So lawsuits were filed and the administration lost everywhere.
Yeah, that's what I remember. Well, so yeah. Why did it? Okay, well, you're getting.
Yeah. So it was, and here's how they lost. Right. So the argument is an argument on equal protection grounds, and here is that there's kind of an interesting law explainer here that I'm going to embed in the middle of this horrible discussion. The 14th Amendment says no state shall deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws, right? And so the very first thing you might ask is, well, wait, the military isn't a state,
right?
Yeah. The military is under the supervision of the U.S. government. We talked about the incorporation doctrine in a bunch of previous cases, right, in which the Supreme Court said that the 14th Amendment incorporated the Bill of Rights out to the state. That's why the state of New York cannot violate your First Amendment rights. There's also a doctrine of reverse incorporation. It's a 1954 case. It's called Bowling versus Sharp, that says the Fifth Amendment, right, which says that the federal government will not deprive you of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, reverse incorporates the provisions of the 14th Amendment as part of the definition of liberty. This is an interesting sidebar again for our originalist friends. The Bowling decision was a 9-0 decision in a pretty conservative, well, in a middle of the road, at least, Supreme Court in 1954. It was not remotely controversial at the time, and it absolutely is the kind of opinion that this Supreme Court could not issue, and that anyone following in originalist logic is sort of forced to deride that opinion. And so, you know, it's kind of yet another area in which the originalists are way out of touch with, you know, only 80 years of jurisprudence and the overwhelming wishes of the American people. Anyway, so the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment is reverse incorporated back to the federal government. And what that means is that you can bring a challenge to argue that an action of the federal government, clearly this is, violates equal protection of the law. And this is a good time for us to do a little mini explainer on what that means, right?
Right.
Because all the time, laws treat different people differently, right? If we say, you know, take the law that says felons can't vote in federal elections, right? Well, that treats one group of people, felons, differently from another class of people, non-felons. So in other words, the fact that laws treat people differently is not dispositive. And we've talked about the, you know, does this mean Nazis get to bake cakes? And does this mean James Damore gets to sue Google because he's a Republican? The way in which you win an equal protection clause is as follows. You're the plaintiff. You demonstrate that you've been treated differently from others who were similarly situated. You then have to show that that treatment was the result of intentional or purposeful discrimination. And then the burden shifts back to the government to determine whether the disparity in treatment can be justified by the requisite level of scrutiny. And that requisite level of scrutiny depends upon what class you're in terms of the class that was discriminated against, right? So if you're a member of what the court calls a suspect class, discriminated against on the basis of that class, then what applies is strict scrutiny, which basically means the law is almost certain to be struck down. Strict scrutiny applies to three things. It applies to discrimination on the basis of race, on the basis of national origin, and on the basis of religion. On the other hand, if you're not a member of a protected class, then what applies is rational basis, right? So felons, not a protected class. Republicans, not a protected class. If rational basis applies, then what the government has to demonstrate is that there is a rational basis for discriminating between the classes of people in the law. And that rational basis test is super easy to prove. And that's why all of the distinctions that we have in the law.
The fog mirror test, is it that?
Yeah, or, yeah, that's exactly what it is, right? The fog mirror, you put a mirror under the legislator's nose, and if it fogs up to indicate that they're breathing, it passes rational basis. In recent years, courts have actually done a little bit of a substantive inquiry in rational basis cases, including in this case, and I'm going to talk about that in a second. But really where this battle is being fought is over what is considered a quasi-suspect class and to which the doctrine of intermediate scrutiny applies. If intermediate scrutiny applies, you have to show, as the government, quote, exceedingly persuasive justification, end quote, for drawing the distinction in the law. The only quasi-suspect class is gender, right, is sex. And again, those are the terms being used by the courts, right? I understand, you know, I'm not endorsing that particular language. But the crucial thing is, and we talked about this when we talked about the Hively versus Ivy Tech decisions and the Zarda versus Altitude Express decision. That was the last time we talked about those cases was in episode 152, by the way. There is no Supreme Court decision that recognizes either sexual orientation or gender identity as falling under the suspect classification, right, under this level of intermediate scrutiny. There are decisions at the Circuit Court of Appeals, right? So if you're in a state that is within the jurisdiction of the Second or the Seventh Circuit, then those courts do recognize that discrimination on the basis of gender identity is equivalent to discrimination on the basis of sex. And to be honest, unlike the hurdle that you have in the Hively and Zarda decisions, which has to do with the legislative history of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. If you're just talking about the Equal Protection Clause, the argument that discrimination against trans men and women should fall under at least intermediate scrutiny is really, really strong. It comes from a case called Glenn versus Brumby, which is an 11th Circuit decision. So again, you have these decisions at the circuit court level, but you don't have them coming from the Supreme Court, right? So the Supreme Court is free to write on a blank slate. But here's what Glenn versus Brumby says, right? They start with all of the discrimination on the basis of sex decisions, right? And the two kind of most famous ones really are a case called Mississippi University for Women versus Hogan, which is a 1982 case, and then a subsequent decision, U.S. versus Virginia, regarding the Virginia Military Institute. And both of those cases were about admitting members of the opposite sex to those educational institutions, right? So the Mississippi University for Women, obviously, did not admit men. And the Supreme Court said, yeah, you've got to admit men. VMI, the Virginia Military Institute, did not admit women. And the Supreme Court said, no, you've got to admit women. And in both cases, they quoted from the same language, which was then quoted again in the Glenn versus Brumby decision. State actors, which includes the U.S., controlling the gates to opportunity, we have instructed, may not exclude qualified individuals based on fixed notions concerning the roles and abilities of males and females. Hmm. Right. So think about that in VMI. Right. Like the VMI argument was, hey, this is a rough military academy and we just keep out those, you know, precious little women because they couldn't pass our rigorous physical entrance exams anyway. And the Supreme Court said, yeah, that's not good enough, right? Yeah, you want to administer physical tests? Great. But let women take the tests.
Right.
You cannot use broad-based views of what women are like to exclude them from those opportunities. And that is precisely what the 11th Circuit seized upon in the Glenn versus Brumby case. Right. They said, look, as those cases continue to develop, that there was a subsequent Supreme Court decision, Price Waterhouse versus Hopkins from 1989, that made it explicitly clear that discrimination on the basis of gender stereotyping is sex based discrimination. Right. And so they put all of that together and said, look, it doesn't matter how you look at it. And the court, you could see, this was the 11th Circuit, a conservative circuit. By the way, this was a unanimous 3-0 panel that was joined by William Pryor, one of Donald Trump's potential nominees to the Supreme Court. Right. And in fact, one of the guy that I said was a dark horse candidate, if you really wanted to trigger the libs, someone who has a long and outspoken history of saying hateful things about LGBTQ people, nevertheless, did not dissent from this opinion because it's super clear. Right. So as a result of that, and as a result, I think of this clear application, all of these courts at the district court level enjoined the trans ban policy. And as you know, Thomas, right, the fundamental question when you're talking about issuing a preliminary injunction, right, you've got the other standards, is likelihood of success on the merits.
Right.
Right. And the court said, yeah, no, we think the plaintiffs are going to have no trouble proving likelihood of success on the merits. In fact, and now I'm going to quote from Stone again. This was the Maryland case, but they were all pretty similar. The Stone decision said, moreover, this court finds that based on the exhibits and declarations currently on the record, the directives, that is Trump's tweet and executive order, are unlikely to survive even a rational basis review. The lack of any justification for the abrupt policy change, combined with the discriminatory impact to a group of our military service members who have served our country capably and honorably, cannot possibly constitute a legitimate government interest. So that
end
seems
of story. That should settle it.
It should. And so what the Trump administration did was said, OK, well, then we're going to go back to the drawing board. And I am going to instruct Jim Mattis to conduct an internal study and come up with a new policy that survives rational basis review. And then the battle will just be.
My memory was that Mattis wasn't necessarily that bad on this issue. Like, I thought he would. Am I misremembering?
You're misremembering.
Okay, sorry. My fault.
Mattis went. And again, I don't know what's in his heart of hearts. I don't know where he is on this issue. I know the study that they came up with is a 42-page study. I'm going to link it in the show notes. It is conducted by talking to people in the military, right? So basically, there's no independent verification. It raises the arguments that it raises are, and I am not making this up, one, mental health is going, you know, the mental health disparity of trans service members will undermine combat readiness. Two, physical health. And three, and again, I wish I were making this up, the need for separate bathrooms. And other, you know, sex-based discrimination that's currently in the military that's okay. That's the justification.
Why do they need separate bathroom? I don't understand.
Because what the report says is that implementing the open service directive would interfere with current sex-based regulations that are already in place in the military and that are already constitutionally permissible, such as having separate bathrooms for men and women. And again, it's based on the fact that the report assumes that the definition of a person's gender is the role that you were assigned at birth, which they call your biological gender. So the report reifies something that is not supported in the medical and psychological literature and is, you know, of course, kind of the key to the trans people don't exist. They're not really men. They're not really women. Side of the argument. So the Mattis directive, which came out February 22nd of this year, is described by the Trump administration as replacing the earlier Trump order, but is very clearly just implementing the Trump order. Mm-hmm. And no court to date has fallen for the notion that that this replaces, right? Because we've talked about how in the past, right, when one of the ways in which Trump was able to stall resolution of the Muslim ban was by rescinding prior executive orders and issuing new ones, right? Changing them in material ways. This does not change the prior policy in a material way. Here's what it says. It says that, A, if you have undergone transition, if you are a service member and you have undergone transition or, quote, require, end quote, undergoing transition, which is then defined as having a diagnosis of gender dysphoria, you may not be recruited, you may not enlist, and you may be terminated, subject to the exception that I'm going to talk about in a second. B, if you're trans, quote, without gender dysphoria, then you can serve, and again, I want to emphasize, this is their discriminatory language, you can serve, quote, in their biological sex, end of quote. Yeah, and so we've talked about that. There is a database that is maintained. It is called the Defense Enrollment Eligibility Reporting System, DEERS. And so what trans service members do is, what some trans service members have done, is change that marker in that database, right, from female to male.
Well, yeah, because as I, you know, I interviewed a trans person in the military on my show as well, because the one of the more tragic aspects of this is the fact that because the policy was changed under Obama, trans people who might have been kind of, you know, quote unquote, in the closet before in the military came out and like notified their superior, that kind of thing. So like there are people who thought, okay, finally the coast is clear, I can be myself here, became open about the fact that they were trans. And now a couple years later, that's in what I think is a really horrifying betrayal, that can be used as evidence that they can't be in their job now.
Yeah. And that's 100% correct. And what the Mattis policy does to try and respond to that is craft, see the exception, which I told you to put a pin in, and let's look at that now, because this is going to become crucial for trans service members. So the exception has two components to it. The first is service members who are diagnosed with gender dysphoria after entering military service may be retained without waiver, provided they are willing and able to adhere to all standards associated with their biological sex. And again, that's nonsense, but that's what the policy says. The service member does not require gender transition, and the service member is not otherwise non-deployable for more than 12 months for a period of time in excess of that established by the service policy, which may be less than 12 months. I don't know how that third calculation, the non-deployable calculation, is made. I've talked to a couple of folks. We'll follow up on it. But basically says, so section one, I read that as saying, you can try and get back in the closet for now. But, right, you have to identify by the gender that you were assigned at birth, and you have to not transition. You have to continue, you know, you have to continue in the gender you were assigned at birth. Exception two says, transgender service members who were diagnosed with gender dysphoria by a military medical provider after the effective date of the Carter policy, June 30th, 2016, right? But before the effective date of any new policy, put a pin in that. This is crucial. May continue to receive all medically necessary treatment to change their gender marker in DERS, and to serve in their preferred gender even after the new policy commences. This, according to the study, will apply to 937 of the 14,000 service members. I want to read the exceptions to the exception because this is important. This includes trans service members who entered into military service after January 1, 2018, when the Carter policy took effect by court order. The service member must, however, adhere to the procedures set forth in the regulations, may not be deemed to be non-deployable for more than 12 months, right? The same non-deployable issue. And then here's the really, really crucial part, and nobody that's reporting on this has pointed this out. There's an explicit severability clause. Here's what the policy says. While the department believes that its commitment to these service members, including the substantial investment it has made in them, outweighs the risks identified in this report, should its decision to exempt these service members be used by a court as a basis for invalidating the entire policy, the exemption instead is and should be deemed severable from the rest of the policy. So, what does that mean? That means that if a court were to look at the exception and argue under equal protection that that should apply not just to those service members who got a gender dysphoria diagnosis between June 30th, 2016 and whenever the implementing regs, which are going to come out any day now, right? Maybe within a few days of the show dropping, and then says, okay, well, the only way that creates an artificial distinction between those service members and other trans service members, what this says is then the Department of Defense, the branches of the military, will kick this exception and everybody will be forced back into the closet. So it's bad now. It could get worse. And they have deliberately built in a mechanism to potentially make it worse. They would rather save the policy than permit the exception and permit those 14,000 trans service members to continue to serve with distinction. I don't need to tell you that's bad. What's coming next? After having painted a terrible picture of what's going to happen, I don't want to undercut that. This is going to happen. This is going to affect. I want to say, like, look, if you're a trans service member right now, I don't know what to tell you to do.
Yeah.
Right. Because on the one hand, right, if you try and race out and get a gender dysphoria diagnosis right now, number one, you might not be in the position to want that, right? But suppose, you know, this forces you to act and you say, okay, well, I'm going to go try and get within this safe harbor provision. Two things could happen to you. Number one, right, your evaluation, because it must be from a military medical provider, right? Cannot be from your own private doctor. That diagnosis could stay pending, right? The doctor could say, okay, well, I'm writing up my report. And then all of a sudden, the implementing regs come out and now you're outside the safe harbor period, right? And now, right, this brings you into category A, right? Like, it just is. And then, of course, the second thing, right, the military might kick this when they're arguing in court. They might go, okay, yeah, well, we're going to sever out this part of the exemption. I don't know what to do. I mean, I am. It's just one of those moments where I'm struck with kind of the recognition of overwhelming privilege of, you know, you and I don't have to face those kinds of decisions, and you know, I can say my heart goes out to those who do, and I don't know what else to say. It does not, right, the fight on the merits is not over, and I want to be super clear on that. It is not. This is what was before the Supreme Court were two things. The first is the petition to stay the effect of these decisions, which was granted. Weirdly, and this picks up the procedural thing that I talked about before, weirdly, they did not, the government did not file a petition in the Stone case. They only filed in the other three cases. And so that it's sort of made it rounds a little bit, but it doesn't matter, right? That the stay, the injunction in Stone is now res judicata. It's been decided by the Supreme Court. So it will be lifted in Stone as well. So that's super bad for all the reasons that we just went through. But the second thing the government asked for was for a writ of certiorari before judgment. I'm going to talk about that on Tuesday's show because it deserves its own segment.
Okay.
But those were denied. So certiorari before judgment is all of these decisions are at the district court level. They are pending before various circuit courts of appeal. And what the government wanted to do was bypass the Fourth Circuit, the Ninth Circuit, and have the Supreme Court take it up. And the Supreme Court said, yeah, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to let those cases litigate out in the various respective circuit courts of appeal. But we're going to let the ban go into effect while those cases are being litigated. Remember that denying an injunction, right? Granting an injunction is a signal that the court says, yeah, we think you're right. We think you're right on the merits. So when you win on an injunction, that's a pretty strong signal of where that court is headed. Denying an injunction means that you have not met the threshold of showing a substantial likelihood of success on the merits.
Right,
and
right.
So you could go before the court and say, okay, we weren't able to persuade you that we were substantially likely to win on the merits. We get that this court thinks that it's a close case. Here's why we're still right on the merits.
Right.
And I believe the Fourth and Ninth Circuits in particular are going to apply the 11th Circuit precedent. It will go up to the Supreme Court. And then the question will be, we know where the hardcore, and I can't believe I'm drawing this distinction, we know where Gorsuch, Alito, Kavanaugh, and Thomas are going to come out. The question is John Roberts going to draw some kind of arbitrary line that effectively overrules the 11th Circuit's opinion?
So since the Supreme Court, I guess, undid the stay or stays, does it then go back? So it's back down in the circuits now, or is the Supreme Court deciding on the merits, like,
no,
automatically?
Okay. So it's neither of those, right?
Neither
so what
of those.
So what happened is, right, the district courts entered in a preliminary injunction, right? Those cases are in various stages of appeal, right?
Okay.
Because some of those cases have been adjudicated on the merits and have then been appealed up to circuit courts of appeal. Some of those cases are still in the process of getting a final determination because of the shenanigans with the February Mattis memo, right? And so there was a whole bunch of new procedural motions to dismiss, with which those cases, turned around and said, no, that didn't moot out the case. It's still the same issue. It's still the same policy. So what this does is this stays the enforcement of the judgment pending appeal. And so it says it doesn't overturn the decisions, it doesn't rule on the merits, and it is not ripe for the Supreme Court to rule on the merits because no circuit court of appeal has ruled on the merits yet. That's what the petition for certiorari before judgment was meant to do. It was meant to say, okay, hey, you don't need the Fourth Circuit to weigh in here. You should get rid of the stay, take it up, and then presumably, you know, that was done with the idea that the Supreme Court would then reverse, right? So it will still be adjudicated on the merits at the various circuit courts of appeal. And I think that the circuit courts are going to come out, are going to follow Glenn versus Brumby. It feels really, really straightforward to me. And then the question is what the Supreme Court will do.
Yeah.
I don't have a whole lot of hope, but I do have some hope.
I know we're out of time, so a couple just quick sentences. The cruelty is the point. The parties are not the same. Blank Boxman for president 2020. Because the Democrats won't do this. They're not the same. Not the same.
Yep. Absolutely. Here.
Blank or blank box woman. By the way.
Yes. Oh, perhaps there's so blank, many blank box women.
Yeah. All right. It's going to be great. Okay. So if we're kind of bottom lining this, correct me if I'm wrong here, but it sounds like there's not a lot you or I or anybody can do right now. It's still going through the appeals process. And, you know, once if it gets all the way to SCOTUS and they rule, you know, there's nothing we can do then. What's your main takeaway from this? How do you feel about it?
Yeah. So that's it. That's exactly right. So I would say there are two takeaways here. The first is it remains a live question to be adjudicated on the merits as to whether gender identity or being a trans man or woman is an intermediate, requires intermediate scrutiny under the Equal Protection Clause. And I think we will see good decisions from the Fourth Circuit, from the Ninth Circuit in the near term. We're still kind of waging the battle to determine what the Equal Protection Clause means. But I think the Glenn v. Brumby case is super, super clear. And that's where I think that's headed. Obviously then to the Supreme Court. That's sort of the second thing. And this is a little bit of a teaser for next week. I think that it is significant that the Supreme Court declined to issue writs of certiorari before judgment in this case. I'm going to tell you why, and we're going to talk about just how activist the Supreme Court is and will be on next Tuesday's show.
There you go. Good teaser. I'm very curious to hear that. But all in all, this segment was every bit as depressing as I thought it would be and more. This is horrible, and we're really, our hearts go out to anybody, any trans people I know, and we know several of them, trans people in the military. It is amazing when you look at those numbers, you know, it's more people than you might think. And, those are real people who are now worried about whether or not they can still have their job and their career and their paycheck. for no good reason. Absolutely no good reason. It's horrifying. So hopefully the courts will go the right way eventually. But it definitely feels really powerless right now. It sucks.
Yeah. Yes, it does.
All right. Well, let's try to rapid fire through some shutdown stuff here. We're a little long, but you know, there's a lot to talk about, and I think it's worthwhile. You know, a lot of this stuff deserves a lot of time. So, hey, listeners, here's a tip. No guy looks good in a long, bulky dress shirt when it's untucked. You might think it looks casual, but it ends up looking sloppy, and we don't want to look sloppy. That's because they were never meant to be worn that way. Untuck It makes shirts specifically designed to be worn untucked. They're not too long and they're not too short for that clean, casual look you can even wear at the office. With more than 50 fit combinations, Untuck It shirts look great on tall, short, slim, and athletic guys of all ages. Go to untuckit.com or visit one of Untuck It's 50 stores across the US and Canada. And the website is great. It shows you the variety they have, the colors, what they might look like. They've got a great sizing chart to figure out maybe what body type you need to have the shirt that will fit you best. So Untuck It even offers free shipping and returns on all orders in the U.S. Use the promo code OA for 20% off your first purchase. So if you want the perfect fitting shirt, regardless of your shape and size, try the original untucked shirt. And remember, use promo code OA for 20% off your first purchase. Let's do some quick shutdown questions.
No, I think I am very restrained, and I talk about important things.
I'm going to do very restrained if I use it at all. I'm going to do very restrained. I find it tremendous. It's a modern form of communication. There should be nothing you should be ashamed of. It's where it's at.
All right.
Hold on. From patron Eric Trump? What? I guess we found the Trump's new legal strategy, I guess. I mean, yeah, it's not like Giuliani is working out. So this is, they can pledge the show and ask us legal questions.
I am positive that's cheaper than hiring Rudy Giuliani. So think about it. There we go.
Do you mean cybersecurity expert Rudy Giuliani? who has standing to bring a suit to challenge an order returning them to work? So is this talking about the kind of the IRS thing where Trump's like, oh, I'm just going to make people go return to work for free? Or is that just,
exactly right? Exactly right. And I'm going to try and answer all of these before the explanation with 1 to 3 words. So the answer there is any worker. And I'm going to link in the show notes. I don't know why more of these haven't been filed. Recently, we talked about the air traffic controllers union case. That's still pending, by the way. I mean, Judge Leon denied the TRO, but as we just explained in the last segment, he could still revisit that on the merits. The recent lawsuit that was filed on behalf of anonymous high senior government officials was filed under the Fair Labor Standards Act, right? And as we know, right, that provides for mandatory minimum wage and paid overtime. And what it says is that, and that statute also provides for double your actual damages plus your attorney's fees. So if you're an FLSA attorney, start talking to some federal employees and get these lawsuits filed. I'm 100% serious. It's at least as good a chance that you're going to get your attorney's fees as the suits you likely bring. So any worker. Next.
What drives me nuts is this when these shutdowns happen and Republicans can be like, yeah, things are still work. We don't need the government. Things are still fine. It's like, yeah, indentured servitude works out great for the employer. That's awesome. Yeah. If the government still kind of scrapes by because people are working for free because they're scared to lose their jobs. And it does work out great for us for you know, that's cool. Cool system. Anyway,
yeah.
If the federal courts are shut down, would the lawsuits even be heard?
The answer to that is eventually. We talked about last week the reporting by the federal courts that they were going to run out of money on the 18th. The latest word from kind of, I guess, overturning couch cushions in the court lounges is that the federal courts will remain funded through February 1st, with the caveat that, quote, there will be no more extensions, end of quote. So they have kind of pinched every last dime. At that point, all of your cases, all of my cases in federal court that are not imminent criminal cases, I think are going to get stayed. It's going to be bad.
Yeah, I was just thinking, like, judges are probably not the kind of people who are like, I might lose my job. I might get, they're going to hire a new me if I don't work.
No, you mean, like, you mean those with lifetime tenure? Yeah.
I think they're like, oh, nope, no paycheck, no work, bye. Pretty sure that's how that goes. Okay, this one may take a little explaining. Considering how long a lawsuit might take, are there any more expedient ways to prohibit the administration from violating the Anti-Deficiency Act?
Nope.
Okay, nope. But can you explain what that means exactly?
Yeah, so the question is there any other way to enforce the Anti-Deficiency Act other than by bringing lawsuits? And the answer is, right,
the
Department of Justice
works.
And the furloughed prosecutors could, I guess, you know, bring
or
criminal,
like,
charges.
Maybe some sort of militia, maybe,
yeah.
I don't
know. but that's never been done in the history of the ADA. So no. Yeah.
Okay.
Next
one here. Is there any mechanism to prevent the administration from making very aggressive interpretations of the exceptions to the ADA to put virtually all furloughed workers back on the job without pay?
And the answer here is no, with an asterisk. And the asterisk is, eventually, I believe the courts will slap down those overly aggressive interpretations. But if you're asking, can we get an injunction, right, that the first step of that was Judge Leon's decision not to grant an injunction in the air traffic controller's case. Now, another judge may see things differently, right? Denial of an injunction does not preclude, has no long-lasting effect on whether another court says, yeah, you know what, this has reached a stage, the tipping point, where irreparable harm and the balance of harms is too great. But for right now, the answer to that is no.
Assuming that people back on the job is an actual violation of the ADA, who could or would be held criminally or civilly liable? That's a good question.
And the answer here is everybody except Trump. 13 U.S.C. 1350 provides that an officer or employee of the U.S. government who knowingly and willfully violates the Anti-Deficiency Act shall be fined not more than $5,000, imprisoned for not more than 2 years or both. So that could apply to anybody. Again, you have to meet the standards of knowingly and willfully, right? So if you're just following orders, that probably will immunize you. But could it apply at the cabinet level, right? Could it apply at the heads of executive agencies level? I see no reason to think that it couldn't. The only person to whom I think it does not apply is to Trump himself under the clear statement rule, which we talked about in connection with the Barr memo. So everybody else.
Final question that a lot of people are asking, why does Congress still get paid?
Yeah, and the answer here is the Constitution. As it turns out, all of the provisions for payment, right, of Congress, of the president, and of judges come from provisions in the Constitution. So when you see,
judges will still get paid. So it's just the other people that work in the courts that are shutting it down.
Yeah, it's everybody else who is not an Article III judge will not get a paycheck, including the judge's clerks, including the clerk of courts, including the people that the judges really, really need. I mean, trust me, somebody who has judges for friends, you really need to have, you know, your clerks and the clerk of court and the staff.
Okay, but you know how we always talk about making an actual good lot awful movie or show? You know, like, what if the plot is technically the only people who can work are these federal judges, and they haven't done this kind of grunt work in a million years, and they have to, like, operate the whole courthouse themselves to try to get a critical decision. What do you think? Does that work?
I love it.
Right. Like, how do you work this machine here, this fax machine? I don't know.
This strikes me as a Will Ferrell vehicle, right?
Yeah, it's going to be one of those comedies, but with a heart, you know, like they're really trying to get an important decision, done, but they have to do all this funny stuff along the way. Okay, I think it's good. I think it's
all right,
and it's plausible. All right. And then, you know, I saw this question and I know we're running long, but I thought it was a really good one. And I have to apologize because I cannot remember or find where I saw it. It popped up on my phone, you know, and I was busy with something and I could not find it. I checked email, Patreon, Twitter. So listener, if you want to get a shout out, you let me know. But someone asked us, you know, regarding the shutdown, like, hey, I'm curious how you and Andrew would feel if, you know, should a liberal president shut down the government for something like a higher minimum wage, or it might have been, I'm forgetting exactly what it was, but some liberal policy like a guarantee, like jobs guarantee or minimum wage or something like that, or universal basic income, which I thought was interesting. Like, phrase it the other way. Would you support this for a good policy? And I thought it was super easy. Unequivocally, no, I would not support that because that's just not how governance works. You don't turn the way a country works is not turning it into a competition of who can be more heartless towards some hostages. And then that's who wins policy battles. That's not sustainable. It's just not sustainable. And to the people who still disagreed with us last week or whatever, imagine, okay, sure, this policy is the meaningless wall that, you know, it's not the worst thing in the world because it won't work and it doesn't cost like that much of our budget. The next thing is, well, until we shut down Obamacare or until we shut down, you know, until we gut Medicare, whatever, think of the next policy of this. If the precedent is set that Trump can hold hostages to get stuff done, where does it end? You cannot allow that to be the way the government works. You can't. And then I wanted to ask you this, Andrew. The only thing I thought of where it's like, ooh, that would almost be tempting was, what if back when McConnell refused to have a hearing over Merrick Garland, you know, is that the kind where like one co-equal branch of government is not allowing the executive branch to use their authority? Would that then be a reasonable use of this like kind of situation of like, well, then, you know, then I'm shutting down the government until you do your job? Still no, but a closer question. I was just wondering if you had any quick thoughts on that.
I don't think I could say any of that better than you have. You stole the example I was going to go with to kind of push you. The Garland hearings were during an already funded session of government. But, you know, imagine, okay, right, that it had gone over a calendar year. I would not want to say no, if only because, and we have the long rumored, long promised episode on constitutional hardball. I think things are going to get ratcheted to the next level under our next president, Elizabeth Warren. And, I share 100% agreement with what you've said.
All right. I
don't think it's any way to run the government, but I think a storm is brewing when Republicans are sort of back in the minority, and we've seen what they've done when they've been in the minority. And
another problem with all this is it's a little bit asymmetrical, given that, you know, it shutting down the, like, Democrats are the party of thinking government can help people with problems. You know, like it favors Republicans because there's that bizarre, you know, anti-government wing of Republicans, if that's not all Republicans. And so shutting down the government is something they like to do anyway. So it's hard to use that as a weapon against Republicans.
Exactly right. And look, we should be better than that, right? We should care about the fact that every week of the shutdown costs an eighth of a percentage point in GDP, that 800,000 federal workers are in limbo, that 500,000 are not getting paid, right? That people are miserable right now. And I would hope that our presidential candidates do indeed care about that.
All right. Well, it was a great question, and I just wanted to address that because I thought of the Merrick Garland thing. And I was like, oh, that would be when it was tempting. But it just, again, it's punishing bystanders, though. Like, that's what's, you know, it's not ethical, I don't think. Like, here, you're not doing your job, Congress, so we're going to punish some innocent people by not paying. You know, it's ugly. It's not something that I think Democrats should ever do. So
I agree.
All right. Okay, so, just action-packed show, depressing show, of course, but also critical information there. But it is time to move on to our co-favorite segment. We got to cheer ourselves back up here. Co-favorite segment of the week, that is thanking our top patrons, our Hall of Famers, our all-time greats. And we begin with, we are going to build a Death Star and make Alderaan pay for it. Rudy Giuliani's green room bartender. That's a really good one. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of law. Nah. Stormy McKendrick, second chair clown horn in the Mar-a-Lago Philharmonic. I love how they're second chair clown horn. They couldn't even make it to first chair clown horn. It's hard to be funny every week. Yeah, that's true. It is hard. John Bilderback, Jeff Gelbach, Bored Fuzz Peter is an anagram of BuzzFeed Report. That's so weak. Monica, civilpoliticsradio.com, Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio. Possession is 10 tenths of exorcism law. Man, people are really stepping it up. Thank you. We needed this, everybody. We needed this cheer. So thank you. Registry Matters podcast. Came for the yodels, stayed for the intelligent legal analysis. Burbank Makerspace. Unintelligible real property question. Advocate for a foster child in your community. CasaForChildren.org. DataHeck.com. Business automation making the menial automatic. Thomas Smith is my favorite attorney. Andrew's a close second. Trump the plump grump fell on a frump stump and got a dumped lump. Blank Boxman. A miasma of incandescent plasma. Kurt Robinson, Kiowa Valley Exports for Australian red meat and craft beer. Cosmo, thank God I don't work for the government anymore, blues. Let me be totally clear, I like being totally clear. I'm trapped in a Patreon factory, please send help. Michael Cohen is a no-talent ass clown. Sam Buck, Milo Mead Song, The Halfling Bard and SIU 3L. Chris Rowden, The Getting Off Podcast. Is the shutdown over yet? Nope. Karma Fleet is recruiting. Join your labor union. Together we bargain, alone we beg. Investing in Mexican ladder companies. Mike the Intactivist. Polly Chalk. Don't blame Hillary. Blame the Electoral College, i.e. slavery. Yep, yep. Rob Schreck. James. A wandering minstrel delivering the State of the Union address. Dalen Lee Samus Grix. I don't believe facts... I don't believe Sakashite Fukusumi is really Japanese. Brian Upshaw's last chance for-profit prison. And Anonymous. Thank you, folks, so much. Take it away, Andrew.
And thank you, too. Buttercup's Legal Services upped our pledge, so up yours. 831-CAT-LAW-1. And I want to tell you, Thomas, I called 831-CAT-LAW-1. I'm not going to give it away, but I think folks should give Buttercup a call.
Yeah, give it a call. Yeah.
Thanks to welcoming the newest OA listener, Baby Wendy. Yay, congratulations, Baby Wendy. Lord Dampnut is an anagram of Donald Trump. At Women for Conrad Michaels. That's amazing. Great. You win really the week at Women for Conrad Michaels. Zabby, I see arbitration agreements everywhere. OA has pierced the veil. What has four wheels and flies? A garbage truck? Are we okay? So we're going to do dad jokes now?
Yeah. Right,
cool. On vacation, witty tagline service may be briefly suspended. And Yumelmahe Hafurur, and I'm telling you, I'm pronouncing that as written. So I'm hoping that Anne is that is like one of the names of those Scottish towns. But Yumelmahe Hafurur, wordorigins.org, your site for etymological rabbit trails. Derek, thanks for the nightmare-inducing TTTBE. You're welcome. Ready to make an entrance, so back on up. Enrage moping nuts is an anagram of opening arguments. Saul, Big Easy Blasphemy, a string of unpronounceable characters, unemployed C-clamp inspection officer, do not buy Safeway Southern style hash browns, not good at all. Well, good to know. See, it's like, it's a community,
yeah,
like a
opening arguments, airing petty grievances since 2016.
Brandon Smith, jurisprudence falsely so called. That's an exceptional reference there. Thomas and the Bible is my favorite podcast. There are no close seconds. Wow. Well, that, by the way, is how I came across one Thomas Smith. So
there you go.
Rhonda is wearing her amicus briefs. Yeah, me too. Malika Chandler, Jeremiah's Fancy Microwave Emporium, Abacus Flinch, CampQuest.org, 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 Soggy Pants, Sam Danow, Greg Sullivan, Aaron's inability to read names is influencing Thomas.
So true.
Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter to see what Thomas promised in OA 32.
Ooh, wow. Nice one.
Adopt a homeless pet and oppose declawing and ear docking. Matthew Vernon, Danny Baker at Combat Nonsense, Aaron Grady, hundreds of hamburgers. Ian and Ali, Sakishite Fukusumi is an anagram of make U.S. hiatus if ask. Saint Muller, patron saint of yodelers. Eli Bosnick, Mitchell, philosopher, I hardly know her. Rudy Giuliani is a modern day Nathan Thurm. That is an amazing quality. Oh, it was a Martin Short character on Saturday Night Live who was this lawyer who would be
right.
I'm not being defensive. You're being defensive. you should check out Nathan Thurm. That's a great reference. Used Carl Salesman, Mormon J. Fox Esquire, and our all-time great, our number one, the best, the apex of the pyramid, and apparently quite the sex symbol, according to @women4, Conrad Michaels.
Oh, so great. And also, yeah, I think we didn't get a chance to throw this out on the show yet. Definitely at OA Wiki. Give that a follow. The Wiki crew is starting a Twitter account, which I think is great. They can kind of answer questions. So if you ever want to ask a random, you know, OA trivia kind of question, ask OA at OA Wiki. I'm sure they'll be happy to help. So awesome.
And they are amazing. The work that they have done is just fantastic.
And thank you so much to all our top patrons. Again, go to patreon.com/law, pledge at the $5 above level for a month is how you get your shout out. So thanks so much to everyone who does. And holy smokes, we're already at the end of another month. So another Lot Awful Movie is going to be coming at you and a Q&A. So look forward to all that.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
Okay, it's time for TTGBE. I think I'm on, holy moly, an improbable three-question streak? Four? Three? Something like that.
You might be a four by now.
Ooh.
Yeah, could be.
I didn't get anyone, because Andrew was totally wrong in his math the other week, and I don't remember anyone chirping at you for it, but that's okay. Guys, make fun of Andrew when he's wrong at math more. That's all I have to say.
All right. Just for that, here's the question you get.
Oh, no. I take it back.
A bottling company sent a purchase order to a wholesaler that stated, ship 100,000 empty plastic bottles at the posted price. 2 days after receipt of this purchase order, the wholesaler shipped the bottles and the bottling company accepted delivery of them. Mm-hmm. A week after the bottles were delivered, the bottling company received the wholesaler's acknowledgement form, which included a provision disclaiming consequential damages. After having used the wholesaler's bottles in its bottling operations for 2 months, the bottling company discovered a defect in the bottles that caused liquids to leak from them. The bottling company recalled 10,000 of the bottles that had been filed, incurring lost profits of $40,000. Assuming that all appropriate defenses are timely raised, will the bottling company likely to succeed in recovering $40,000 in consequential damages from the wholesaler?
Huh.
A, no, because buyers are generally not entitled to recover consequential damages. B, no, because the bottling company's acceptance of the goods also constituted an acceptance of the terms included in the wholesaler's acknowledgement. C, yes, because the disclaimer of consequential damages is unconscionable. Or D, yes, because the wholesaler's acknowledgement did not alter the terms of an existing contract between the parties.
Very interesting question. I don't think we've had one quite like this. I thought it was going to, you know, go one direction. It kind of went another. It's interesting. So let's see. I think the timeline's important. So ship 100,000, send a purchase order. Ship 100,000 at the posted price 2 days after receipt of the purchase order. Okay, the wholesaler shipped them a week after they were delivered. The bottling company received the wholesaler's acknowledgement form. So that seems bad. Yeah, it's like, a week later. Oh, by the way, those 100,000 empty plastic bottles I sent you, they cause cancer or something. You know, that doesn't seem acceptable. but okay, so they used it for 2 months, though. After having used the wholesaler's bottles in its bottling operations for 2 months. Oh, now that complicates it, because, like, why didn't they stop sooner? Bottling company discovered a defect. Ooh, this is a tough one, because, like, I feel like sending in a week late, not exactly acceptable. However, they used the bottles for 2 months. So if we look at the answer, can they recover 40,000? So it's lost profits of 40,000. That's profits. So it's not just the cost of the goods. So that's interesting. So can they recover the 40,000 profits? No, because buyers are generally not entitled to recover consequential damages. Consequential damages. That doesn't seem right. I would think buyers would be entitled to recover consequential damages at least sometimes. So I'm kind of not thinking A. B, no, because the bottling company's acceptance of the goods also constituted an acceptance of the terms included in the wholesaler's acknowledgement. That's interesting. That could be the answer because, okay, on one hand, I would say that that doesn't seem right because they got the notice, the acknowledgement form, a week after the bottles were delivered. However, they used the bottles for 2 months. So this is a tough one because it's not clear. Like, had they used the bottles for that week and then got the acknowledgement and then said, whoa, 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 this is not right, then that would be a different story. But they used it, they seemed to use it for 2 months. So since they did, B seems like it could be a good answer here. C, yes, because the disclaimer of consequential damages is unconscionable. I could see that being it. Like, the disclaimer is like too bad. You know, you can't sell it and be like, oh, minor disclaimer here. These are terrible and don't work. You know, like that. I could see that. I could see C being the answer. D, yes, because the wholesaler's acknowledgement did not alter the terms of an existing contract between parties. That seems nonsensical to me. It doesn't really seem to address the question. I could be wrong, but D seems wrong. I'm really between B and C. And bottling of acceptance. Here's the thing. It could be unconscionable. Okay, consequential damages. I feel like the fact that they used the wholesaler's bottles for 2 months, I think that kind of means they accepted the risks, you know? I feel like they, if you use it for 2 months, then you're like, well, we're going to kind of, it's like the Pinto or something. You're like, well, we're just going to deal with the fallout if there's a, you know what? I'm going to go with B. I think no, because they, the acceptance of the goods. I don't love the exact wording, but I'm going to go with B. That's how I feel. They used it for 2 months. I feel like they kind of accepted, you know, they made their bed, their water bottle bed, and they're sleeping in it. I'm going with B. It's between B and C maybe, but I'm not in love with the precise wording of B, but I think it's the best answer. That's my answer.
All right. And if you'd like to play along with Thomas on TTTB, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media, include the hashtag TTTB, include your answer, your reasons therefore, and we will pick a winner and shower that person with never-ending fame and fortune, including maybe even having Thomas read your name.
We all know that was you in a Freaky Friday situation. Don't pretend. I know you're trying to brush it off.
If you want a Freaky Friday, you have to play in order to get one. So there you go. You know how to do it. Share it out. We'll pick the winner. Shower that person with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune, not guaranteed.
Well, that was jam-packed, but a lot of vital stuff to discuss there. So thanks, Andrew. Great stuff. Depressing stuff. And yeah, gosh, our hearts go out to everybody affected by these horribly cruel and pointless policies. So with that cheery, on that cheery note, we'll see you on Tuesday.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.